It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Thera today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, the United Nations will begin talks in Switzerland aimed at ending the conflict in Syria. Analysts see these talks as the biggest diplomatic push yet to end the war, which has been going on for 3 years.
There was also a report released today showing evidence of war crimes in Syria. The report comes from former war crimes prosecutors and is based on pictures snuck out of Syria.
Here to give us a preview of the upcoming peace talks in Switzerland is Besma Momani. She's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Waterloo in Canada. She's also a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance and Innovation and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Besma, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So the United Nations is hosting peace talks in Switzerland starting tomorrow. Who do we expect to take part?
Well, it's a very large, actually, meeting. In fact, one wonders if there's any hotel rooms after that and the Davos meetings in Switzerland. Many countries who are part of this include the Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others. The regime, the Assad regime, is sending a delegation. The Syrian National Coalition is sending a delegation representing the opposition. The Americans, obviously, many of the European countries. Interestingly, is who's not there. In this case, Iran is not there. Many of the more radical fighters like ISIS, the Islamic State of Syria, which is a offshoot of Al-Qaeda, will not be there. Islamic Front, also another rebel movement, will not be there. Obviously, I think there are many people who have a lot of concerns about whether or not there's an agreement to be done if many of those fighters and those benefactors like Iran are not actually at the table.
Well, let's take a step back for a moment. As we said, the war has been going on for about 3 years now. And let's get a sense of what was behind the war in Syria initially and what started the conflict to where we are now.
You know, I think what I hope your audience realizes, this really was a revolution. It was a revolution of people who, in fact, were motivated to come out after seeing actually horrific image to what we're hearing about today, as your previous segment noted, which was this horrific image of a child, a 13-year-old named Hamza, who was brutally, basically tortured by the Syrian regime. Cigarette butts out on his body. He was castrated. He was bloodied and bruised, and this 13-year-old boy was returned to his family dead and basically told, you know, have another child, forget this one, because in fact he was out at a protest with his classmates and others for, you know, a regime change. And so this really propelled this revolution to move beyond the little town called Daraa to basically becoming a national revolution. And I think that's something that people need to remember. And unfortunately, it has taken on a sectarian tone, but it really was about people saying that no, you know, no government has a right to torture children.
Well, that brings us up to today. Yesterday, former war crimes prosecutors released a report showing evidence of war crimes in Syria in the form of mutilated corpses. Tell us where that report came from and what impact it may be having.
So this was a photographer who worked for the Syrian military that, in fact, was eventually a defector, but collected 55,000 images, tortured bodies, mutilated bodies, some to starvation. 11,000 individuals are assumed to be a part of that. And these are, unfortunately, realities that so many Syrians know today. You know, there are stories percolating, whether it's online, social media, and just, frankly, people who know our family members who have been through this. Hear of these horrific stories of torture at the hands of the regime. It's not a surprise to many Syrians. I think what's a surprise here, or what's actually perhaps a good thing for those who want to see retribution, is the fact that all this data was being collated. And I think the impact of this, hopefully, might be, you know, to really bring some of those countries that continue to support the Assad regime to, in fact, double think about what their support is actually paying for. And that's the systematic, horrific violation of human rights across the country.
Now, some within the Assad regime have seen the pictures and said, how do we even know they're from Syria? They could have been taken outside the country. Where, show us documentation. What kind of response has that gotten?
You know, I think one of the things that is really fascinating about this conflict, it's one of the few that have been done in real time where we have information communication technology out there, not just the pictures that are being taken by this photographer, but there's tons of videos and a huge collection of data, of oral histories by individuals who are working effortlessly at the civil society level to indeed gather all this material so that one day when this conflict is over, some would pay for the crimes that are out there. So I believe that there is probably going to be a lot of sort of triangulation of all this data. Sorry for the academic tone there, but putting this all together, putting a story. You know, we have, for example, 130,000 individuals that have been killed. The Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which keeps a tally, has a name for every single individual. There's an app for your phone where you can find out not only where they died, a video that links to it, you know, who exactly is the family member that claimed this, in this, you know, atrocity. All of that information is being collated at a really rapid pace. So I think there's a lot of data out there that people don't really know about. But indeed, I think the time will come when this will be all put together, and I think it'll be very condemning evidence.
Is what you just talked about, the technology that's involved in identifying the dead and the atrocities committed, is that part of the new face of war these days?
It really is. It's almost a 2.0 in some respect. You know, this is a war that's, you know, being fought online. I mean, there's a Syrian electronic army, as we've seen, as hackers who've gone on to basically undermine different kinds of Western outlets, whether it's AP and other sources. And I think that this is part of the new phase of war. This is a war that's being fought on YouTube. It's being, in some cases, funded because of YouTube, whether it's, you know, radical jihadists being able to get money from certain donors because they can, in fact, attribute this particular mission or this particular, you know, attack against a government force and then seek payments for it. So it's very much being fought. And I think all Syrians in the diaspora know all too well how much of the information is online. But I think the interesting part here will be putting it all together and triangulating it and using that photos that have come out to make condemning evidence against the regime.
So the peace talks are slated to begin tomorrow. What is the best case scenario for a peace accord?
Well, I think few people see some sort of political resolution. What some people are hoping for, at the very minimum, is some sort of humanitarian agreement to allow aid convoys to come into some of the besieged areas of Damascus. Some of these communities haven't seen food in 3 to 4 months. So there is starvation at a mass scale going on, particularly in the Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk. But also other areas such as Aleppo, where the fighting has continued to be at a stalemate, where government forces and rebels are fighting over street and then losing it to the next day. Part of the hope here is that there might actually be a ceasefire for Aleppo to, in fact, allow, in both cases, both parts, in fact, have an interest in redirecting troops because that's not going anywhere. That doesn't solve the fact that the eastern part of the country is completely under the hands of ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliate, and the country is really descending into a terrible state of affairs.
What challenges do you think are the most daunting as we go into these talks?
You know, I think that people don't recognize there are 6 million internally displaced refugees. That's an enormous, enormous burden on everybody in the country. There are, you know, millions outside the country, and that's obviously deplorable as too. But 6 million inside, people are living in parks. People are living and eating off of whatever vegetation they can find, trees. Cats are being eaten, and this is, you know, a society that does not eat that kind of animal. But clearly, desperation and hunger is doing it. It's an enormous tragedy inside this country, and there's, unfortunately, you know, 21 million people left in the country that Assad is really willing to kill and torture in order to achieve his political objectives.
And anything that we should be on the lookout for as the peace talks begin, anything that would signal, a bellwether in how the talks are heading?
You know, I think I'm looking at Lavrov and the Russian representative to see whether or not they're continuing to stand by this regime. I know this evidence is going to be, presented to the Russians forcefully in an effort to really shake them at their core. This is a time when I think, you know, with the Sochi Games and Putin really trying to put on this liberal face all of a sudden, maybe we might just see some sort of pressure on the Syrian government to, in fact, loosen up and to allow some of this humanitarian, openings. But, you know, unfortunately, so many people like myself are just so pessimistic about the prospects of a peace treaty between these parties. And as we haven't had a chance to get into, but the situation on the ground is really not, unfortunately, conducive to peace at the moment.
If the talks fail, what then?
I think we're going to continue to see the enormous rate of refugees pouring outside the country, 2 million plus going in. Let's not forget neighboring countries like Jordan and Lebanon have taken on 20% of their population. It's enormous. 130,000 have been killed. 11,000 of those are children. We have 3 years of no education in some of these countries. Polio, which had been eradicated for, you know, decades in this country, is making a reappearance. It's a calamity of regional proportions that nobody's thought of. It's not Syria about it imploding, it's Syria exploding. And so the region is at stake here. And I think that's putting many of these, you know, countries to come to Geneva. But again, the dynamics inside the country, particularly a fractured opposition and an Assad regime that continues to get replenished by both Iran and the Russians, is not motivating anybody to really sign a peace treaty.
Basma, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this today.
Thank you.
That was Basma Mamani, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Waterloo in Canada. She's also a Senior Fellow at the Center for International Governance and Innovation and a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Coming up, we normally hear from Noah Obshinsky about what's going on in the news in Wisconsin. We'll hear him talk about something else in just a minute. But first, Kristen Durst joins us now from the newsroom with a look at headlines. We are in the thick of soup season right now as the weather gets colder, but what's soup without a crusty loaf of bread? I really don't know. Our next guest is a recent convert to No Need Bread. That's K-N-E-A-D, of course.
Noah Obshinsky joins us now. He's one of our in-house foodies here at Wisconsin Public Radio, along with his role as assistant news director. Noah, good to have you back.
It's good to be here.
So bread, it's kind of intimidating for those of us who love to eat bread but are frightened by cooking it with all the whole the kneading, the rising, the kneading, the punching down. What can you tell me about No-Knead Bread that's going to help people like me get over this love-hate relationship?
It's not intimidating. Let's start there. This is a non-intimidating bread, and that's one of the reasons why I want to sort of preach its merits from the mountaintop, so to speak. To talk about No-Knead Bread, let's get into our time machines a little bit and go back all the way to 2006. And that is when the New York Times did a story about a baker in New York City by the name of Jim Leahy. He's the owner and head baker at Sullivan Street Bakery in New York City. This article was about this No-Knead Bread recipe that he was talking about. And granted, I'm sure No-Knead baking has been around, I don't know, for thousands of years, probably since bread was created in North Africa and that sort of thing. But really, it hit the culinary world by storm in 2006 when this article was written. And basically, people have taken this basic recipe and have just taken it to all kinds of different places. Dessert breads, savory breads, cheesy breads.
So why do you not have to knead it? That's the thing. I mean, do they have, like, you know, some sort of, you know, I don't know, special ingredient or something that kneads it for you?
Yeah, well, there are a few things. And just for our audience sake, we should talk, when we talk about kneading is one of those things that you do when you make a traditional bread at home or in the bakery. And what it really does is it develops the gluten. It allows all those gluten molecules to be in the right place at the right time.
And that doesn't matter whether you have yeast in it or whether it's a quick bread, right? You have to knead any kind of bread.
Well, I mean, in order for the bread to rise, you need the yeast to do its thing. And kneading is important to make sure that what you get at the end of all of this is a bread that has a wonderful crunchy, what we call, well, a crumb, which is sort of the meat of the bread, and also a wonderful crust, a really crisp crust. And so what water allows those molecules to do is to get in the right place. And unlike a traditional bread recipe, which, you know, can take a few hours to make with kneading, this recipe that was brought to the public by Jim Leahy actually relies not only on water, but also time. Most breads take a few hours to make. This bread takes something on the, you know, 12 to 18 hours to actually rise, to ferment. So what Jim and other bakers, home bakers, have relied on is this time for the bread to get to a place where it's ready to bake.
And it's not the typical thing where you put it in a bowl and you cover it up with saran wrap or a towel or something. You need slightly different equipment to do this, right, as I understand it?
It's kind of, you know, most dough that you need it's fairly easy to manipulate in your hand. And in fact, I mean, that's one of the joys of kneading bread. And I'm not dissing traditional kneading here. Kneading is great. There is something that's lost out by doing this recipe. It is very hands-on. But this dough, when you make it, is very wet. It's sort of it's just very wet and very hard to work with. But you just have to realize, you have to trust that it's all that water that's in this recipe that makes such a wonderful bread. And so it's very hard to actually like put out there and roll or manipulate. You do have to do some manipulation. You do have to fold it into a bowl in order to bake it. But it has very little structure compared to other traditional kneading breads.
So you'd have to have a little bit of time to put the ingredients together. You stick it in your pot.
Ah, yes. So we've talked about the two keys to this recipe. A lot of water, which allows the gluten molecules to get where they need to be. We've talked about time, which lets the dough sort of really get to a great place before you bake it. And the pot.
The pot. Yeah, tell us about that.
So as opposed to just putting your bread on, say, in a breadstone in your oven or on a cookie sheet or something like that, which a lot of people do, this recipe from Jim Leahy relies on a enclosed container, something like a Dutch oven or Pyrex, enamel, a Le Creuset, something like that, something with a top on it. And what you do with this recipe is you put it in the oven half an hour before you actually bake it. You take it out when it's smoking hot, and you put the dough in this enclosed container, and you bake it in an enclosed container. And what that does is it makes sure that there's enough moisture in that bread so that you get that wonderful crust that you would normally get at a commercial bakery, you know, down the road. You know, one of those things that's so hard for a home baker to get is that wonderful crispy, crunchy crust, you know, that we all know and love with, you know, something like a baguette, for instance. And, you know, the home baker, we've been told to, you know, brush it with water. You can take a spray bottle and spray it with water. You know, you can paint egg yolks and a combination of egg yolks and water on it. And, you know, you'll get a crust. But with this recipe, by baking it inside an enclosed space like a Dutch oven, you're ensuring that that moisture doesn't escape, and it actually creates that crisp, wonderful crust that you love from commercial bakeries.
So if you had somebody from France who's used to eating a baguette, would they be steamed if you handed them some of this bread or what?
Oh, well played, sir. Well, talking about steaming, though, one of the reasons why you have this wonderful bread...
I wasn't trying to joke because of the steaming, but still, go ahead.
Oh, well, yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you were
just take credit for it, Mike.
Yeah, okay, I'll go with it. Yeah.
So if you ever wonder why...
Is it like a baguette?
Well, this is the thing. If you ever wonder why a bakery has such wonderful crust in their bread, one of the reasons is many of their ovens actually have steam injection. They're introducing steam in baking process.
And that's how you get crust?
Get the crust that we all know and love.
I didn't know that.
That's amazing. What we're doing... because we don't have, you know, $5,000 ovens, is we're sort of recreating that in our homes with a Dutch oven.
That's cool. Now, is it just a big lump of bread when it comes out then, or what does it look
like? Kind of, yeah. It is kind of lumpy. When you look at it, it takes a leap of faith to some extent, because you look at it and you're like, is this going to turn into bread?
And that's when you take it out of the oven?
No.
When you put it in.
When you put it in, you're like, what is this? I mean, maybe a flatbread? No. Just trust the process, trust the recipe, and you will get a wonderful bread when it's all said and done. It needs to be said that the bread doesn't spend its entire time in an enclosed space. 30 minutes is spent with the top on, and then for the last 15 or 20 minutes of that cooking period, so we're talking about a total baking of about 45 minutes, the last 15 to 20 minutes is with the cover off, and that's what helps develop that sort of dark brown, wonderful color that we love with our bread.
Now, I could be completely misreading you, Noah, but you seem very enthusiastic about this bread.
Very.
Does it taste good?
It tastes amazing. It's chewy. It's got lots of big holes in it, which I like, which I value in a bread. Yeah. And it's got a wonderful crust.
And it looks good, too.
And it looks, I mean, it looks like anything you would get at a bakery, to be honest. I mean, it comes very close. And actually, when you take it out of the oven, don't do what I think we're probably all tempted to do, which is to just cut it open and eat it. No. Wait. Have some patience and wait an hour and let that bread cool. And that will really help help you enjoy it to the maximum.
I'm not making a lot of bread in my house. Yeah. But is this a whole lot easier than if you were to make a typical loaf of bread?
It is a lot easier because there aren't many ingredients, 4 or 5 ingredients max, nothing exotic. And really, you're just letting time do all the work. So instead of the technique behind kneading, you know, so you don't have to know anything about kneading. All you have to do is throw 19 hours at this dough. And what comes out is a wonderful piece or a wonderful loaf of bread.
So the 19-hour thing, I mean, does that mean that it's sort of fermenting? Or
it is. It's exactly what's happening. Okay. That's exactly what's happening. The yeast is interacting with the flour, and it's creating that bread. And, you know, 19 hours, if you actually think about it, is kind of a convenient time because you can make this bread in 5 minutes, then go to sleep. Heck, you could go to sleep and then go to work and then come home and the bread will be waiting.
It practically bakes itself.
To be baked.
Well, thanks for joining us, Noah. We appreciate that.
It was good to be here.
Noah is one of our in-house foodies at Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. The latest Gallup poll shows that there are a number of Americans who consider themselves to be political independent at record high levels.
This news makes some analysts say there will be an element of unpredictability in this year's congressional midterm elections.
But our guest political scientist says not so fast. These people who call themselves political independents are actually regular partisan voters. They just like the idea of being independent.
We want to hear from you on this. Do you think the number of political independents in the United States is on the rise? Do you think there's such a thing as a true political independent? Do some people see it as a badge of honor, or is it just window dressing? Why or why not? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Alan Abramowitz is with us to explain why he thinks most independents are really partisans in disguise, stealth partisans. He's a professor of political science at Emory University. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm glad to be with you.
Now, why do you doubt the rise of independent voters in the United States?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that when you look a little bit more closely at these independents, the people who identify themselves as independents, you find that the large majority of them will tell you that they normally lean toward one party or the other. And it turns out that these independent leaners typically vote very similarly to self-declared partisans. In other words, independent Democrats behave like Democrats, independent Republicans behave like Republicans.
Now, why do you think people are saying that they're independent? Are they ashamed of being a Democrat or a Republican or what?
There is, I think, an element of that. There's something that social scientists have called a social desirability effect. And there's been some research on this that indicates that generally people nowadays are somewhat reluctant to acknowledge that they are a partisan, that being a partisan carries a sort of a negative connotation to a lot of folks.
Do you think that's because people are trying to be polite, or is it because of the rise of sort of polarized political discussion in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that it's a response to the perception that that there's all this partisan bickering going on. When we look at Congress, or when we look at many of our state capitals, you'd probably be familiar with this there in Wisconsin, that we see all this back and forth, the fighting between the parties, and that may not be very attractive. So I think a lot of folks are reluctant to call themselves partisans, and there's something appealing about the label independent. You know, everyone wants to think of himself or herself as being an independent thinker. That you vote for the best person or based on issues rather than simply voting blindly for your party. But it turns out that when most people think about the issues or the candidates, they end up preferring candidates that come from the same party pretty much all the time.
Why do you think it's important to bring this up to people?
Well, I think it's important for understanding what's happening in American politics today because, you know, if you look at the voting patterns in recent elections, what you find is there's just a remarkable stability and consistency that going from, say, 2008 to 2012, you know, the same states are voting Democratic and Republican. the same counties are voting Democratic and Republican. You know, we're returning the same party to office pretty consistently. Of course, there's some swing between elections, and midterm elections are different from presidential elections. But nevertheless, you know, you can't understand this remarkable stability, as well as the fact that, you know, so many states, as well as congressional districts today, are, you know, inclined very strongly to support one party or the other. We have many deep red states, many deep blue states, and I think you can't possibly understand that unless you understand something about this strong partisanship that we have developed within the American electorate.
Well, why do you think that more people are partisan than they used to be, or are they?
They are. I think not the way they label themselves, but in their behavior. And I think the reason for it is that the parties are much more divided now than they used to be, that the differences between them are much greater. And therefore, people are more likely to align themselves with one party or the other, at least in behavior, if not in label. And so, you know, when you look at the parties in one election compared with another election, you're seeing a very similar choice, so you're going to respond the same way. No matter where you are in the country today, the choices the parties are presenting to the voters are very similar. The Republican Party is a quite conservative party. The Democratic Party is a pretty liberal party. There's some variation from state to state, but almost everywhere you go, there's a pretty big divide between the parties. And in your state of Wisconsin, actually, you have one of the biggest divides between the parties that we have anywhere.
Yeah, in just a minute, we're going to have some listeners join in on the conversation. If you're listening and want to join in on this conversation, you can do that by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And now, I wonder if there is, and you mentioned Wisconsin is one of those states where there may be more people who say they're independent just because they'd prefer not to say they're a Republican or a Democrat. Are there parts of the country that are more full of independents who really aren't independents than others? I mean, have you seen any of that looking over the country?
There definitely are states where they have party registration. Not every state has party registration. But there are states where they do have party registration where you do get more people registering as independents rather than with a party. And that usually has something to do with the rules regarding voting in primary elections. So in a state like New Hampshire, which, of course, we're all familiar with because of its presidential primary, a lot of folks register as independents or nonpartisan because the rules in New Hampshire allow you to choose either party's primary if you're a nonpartisan or an independent. And if you're a Democrat or Republican, by registration, you can only vote in your own party's primary. So I think a lot of folks go, well, why, you know, limit yourself? You can just register as nonpartisan or independent and then choose which party's primary you want to vote in, depending on which side has a more interesting contest going on.
Well, we're talking to Alan Abramowitz from Emory University. He says that he believes that most independents are partisans in disguise. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones. Kelly from Salem, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So are you an independent?
I would consider myself an independent, and I think it's because neither of the major parties really fit my political beliefs. I'm fiscally conservative and morally liberal, which would probably put me more in the camp of libertarian, but I really care about the environment. There is no true group that fits me, and honestly, I think there's a lot of other people that are out there that fit in that camp, but there's no politician that represents that.
Alan, you want to weigh in on that one?
Sure. I mean, there certainly are some folks who would come down on the liberal side on social issues and the conservative side on economic issues or vice versa. Actually, when you look at the voters today, though, you find that there aren't as many voters who have those sort of conflicting views as there used to be. And most voters, even when they do come down on opposite sides, let's say on social versus economic issues, tend to weight one type of issue more than the other and still end up voting pretty consistently for one party or the other. What you find also is that generally the more politically involved people are, the more they're interested in politics, care about politics, the more they know about politics, and the more they participate, the more partisan they tend to be and the more consistent they tend to be. And that your pure independents, you know, the folks who are not only independent, say they're independent and really don't display any preference for a party one way or the other, they by and large tend to be people who don't pay attention, are not very interested, not very knowledgeable, and often don't vote at all.
Kelly, are you still there? Do you want to respond to that? Do you feel?
Yes, I am. Extremely active in politics and do a lot of research. Ironically, the last three primaries, the last one I voted Libertarian, the one before that Republican, and the one before that Democrat.
Wow.
So I don't necessarily think that's the case.
Huh. Well, we'll have more to talk about. Ellen, I want to...
Kelly may be the exception that proves the rule.
Well, there you go. Well, we have a lot of people interested in talking about that. We'll talk more about... true political independence? Are you like Kelly? Do you vote all over the place? You have a lot of different views? Well, you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue our discussion about political independence with Alan Abramowitz in just a minute. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation with Alan Abramowitz right now about independent voters in the United States. Do they truly exist or are they just really partisan voters in disguise like our guest thinks?
We're also taking your calls. What do you think about what our guest has to say? Do you think the number of political independents in the United States is on the rise, or do you think that people are stealth independents? They're really partisan. Why or why not? Does the label independent mean anything to you? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@WPR.org. And we're going to go straight to the phones. Sean from Appleton, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. So what's your take on this?
Well, I think by and large, it's independent to me just means a nice way to say I'm either going to vote Democrat or Republican, but I'm not stupid enough to say, you know, if there's an awful choice or somebody with, you know, great, we'll say judicial experience for, you know, state attorney general or something like that versus somebody who just looks like a political opportunist. They're going to, you know, vote the way that makes sense. But I also think that it's just a way to either, you know, look cool or seem like, you know, you're a free thinker and you don't, you know, follow party lines. But I think I agree with your guess, you know, largely to the extent that, yeah, it's not really true and it's,
so would you consider yourself an independent?
No. Very, very liberal. I think I'm 30 years old and I've only been voting for about 12 years. And I think I voted for J.B. Von Hollen in the state attorney general. That's about it.
Well, Sean, thanks for that call. It looks like, Alan, at least there's one person who's proving your theory, I guess.
Well, yeah. Let me just throw out another, you know, piece of evidence indicating pretty clearly, I think, that partisanship is alive and well and, in fact, getting stronger. And that's the decline in ticket splitting that, we look at the evidence for, you know, kind of voting patterns over the last 30 years or so, and ticket splitting actually kind of peaked in the 1970s, whether we're looking at president and House or president and Senate or House and Senate or governor and, you know, Congress, whatever combination you choose, there was a lot more ticket splitting back then.
So basically,
more recently, very little ticket splitting.
So basically, you're saying that people are saying they're independent. You're saying that they're being more savvy about who they pick, but they're actually not.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people are looking at the issues, but it just so happens that the large majority of voters tend to mainly agree with one party or the other on the issues, and therefore they vote for that party. It's not that they're blindly voting for the party, as your caller was just indicating. It's based on the differences in philosophy or differences in issues between the Democratic and Republican parties, which are very pronounced right now. And so I think that explains why we're seeing very high levels of party loyalty in voting and more straight ticket rather than ticket splitting.
Well, Sean, thanks for that call. Let's go to Sam in Delafield. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. So what's your take on this?
I would much like the first caller. I'm very socially liberal. I don't care what other people do, whereas I am very fiscally conservative. So I tend to be very frustrated when I'm trying to vote because it tends to be a lot of picking the lesser of two evils.
Do you find yourself splitting your ticket when you vote? I mean, do you vote for some?
Yeah. I mean, I voted Democrat. I voted for Obama, and then I voted for Scott Walker in the recall election. So I split it based on what I think is the better choice of the two, given the two usually pretty poor choices.
That's an interesting observation, Sam. Alan Abramowitz, I wonder if what Sam is saying is suggesting that maybe we need more political parties.
Well, certainly, you know, one of the factors here behind the strength of the two parties and the partisanship of the electorate is the two-party system, and the fact that it pretty much comes down to, you know, you've got to choose between one or the other, or else you feel like you're wasting your vote. That's, you know, a result of the kind of electoral system that we have in this country. We have an electoral system in which it's very difficult for a third party or an independent candidate to win. And we haven't had very many successful independent or third party candidates. So you're kind of stuck with a choice between the two major parties. If we had a different electoral system like they have in some European countries with proportional representation, you know, I think that we might very well have a multi-party system in the U.S., and then, you know, everything would be very different. But that's, you know, not going to happen.
Well, let's continue going to the phones. Lots of people calling in and joining the conversation. If you want to do that, you can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Ellen from Milwaukee, welcome to Central Time.
I agree with this gentleman wholeheartedly. I believe that people are very partisan. I know why I am. And
you're more partisan now? Are you more partisan now than you used to be?
No.
You've always been partisan.
I've always been partisan. I was raised a Democrat and am a Democrat. It runs in the family. It's in the genes. And but if I were restricted from voting in something or another just because I am a Democrat, I would certainly lie and claim myself to be an independent.
So if you lived in New Hampshire, you'd say you were independent.
Yes. If I lived in New Hampshire, I would definitely be an independent Democrat.
and if you were in a room full of Republicans, would you say you were an independent?
No.
Oh, really?
No. Why would I say that?
Well, I was just asking to see if maybe you would be polite.
No. Why would I? That dishonesty isn't polite.
That's true. That's a good point.
If I can break in for, yeah. You know, I suspect that your caller would be unlikely to find herself in a room of Republicans. because this is not specific to her, but that increasingly that, you know, we tend to associate mainly with people who have the same views that we do, support the same party, and we tend to avoid interacting very much with people of the other party unless we're forced to. So, and so that's just another sign of this growing partisanship in our country, that it's affecting interpersonal relationships, particularly, of course, for people who care about politics. There's lots of people who don't care very much about politics, and for them, it's no big deal. But if you care about politics, then, you know, you probably wouldn't want to date someone from the opposing party. You probably wouldn't want your son or daughter to marry a person from the opposing party. You know, this is more true now than it used to be.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Alina in somewhere in Iowa. Alina, welcome.
Thank you.
And what's your take?
Well, I am an independent, and I very much disagree with that we're Republicans or Democrats in hiding, or, you know, that we have a true party. If I would either be a conservative Democrat or a liberal Republican, but I refuse to pick a party because I think we waste ridiculous amounts of money on campaigns and all of those things when there's so many more pressing issues in this country.
But do you find yourself kind of voting for people despite that? I mean, voting for kind of the same kind of
I vote a mixed ticket all the time. I don't look at what their party is. I listen to what they stand for and what they say. I can honestly say I have never voted a straight ticket on anything. I look at who's running and make my decision based on what they have to say.
Well, Alina, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Alan, it seems like we've heard a mixed bag of responses, but based on what you see from looking at data, she's kind of unusual in some ways.
It is, certainly. Thoughtful, truly independent voters who really, you know, look at all the issues and what the candidates stand for and split their ticket are rather unusual. And part of the reason for that is that, again, Democrats pretty much stand for the same thing these days. Republicans pretty much all stand for the same thing. So if you can even kind of lean one way or the other, you're going to tend to vote pretty consistently for one party. We don't find ourselves in a situation where we have, you know, conservative Democrats and liberal Democrats running, or conservative Republicans and moderate to liberal Republicans as we used to. Pretty much the choice almost always boils down to a liberal Democrat versus a conservative Republican. And therefore, if that's the choice you're given for pretty much every office, you know, then you're going to vote pretty consistently. I mean, of course there are exceptions. There's a small number of truly independent voters who are going to split their ticket very frequently and will change sides.
From
one election to the next.
How can looking at people differently than this, since you're suggesting that the independent label is inaccurate, how can we improve the political process if we were just to admit that, okay, you're not really independent, you're leaning in this direction or another? How could we have better conversations about elections if we were to be more open to what you're suggesting is true?
You know, I don't know how we improve the conversation about elections, except that I think that it, from the standpoint of media who cover elections, I think that the most important thing there is for them to understand that these party there are very real and important differences between what the parties stand for and a whole range of issues, and that, you know, most of the reason why we have conflict in Washington and in Madison and a lot of places around the country is because the Democrats and Republicans these days really disagree about what should be done. And it's important for voters to understand that as well and to make their choice based on what direction they want to see their national government or their state government go in, because especially in the states these days, it makes a big difference.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to end it on that. It was a good conversation. Thanks so much for speaking to us today.
Very glad to be with you.
That was Alan Abramowitz, professor of political science at Emory University. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.